This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's All You Can Eat Week on Fresh Air with interviews all about food. Ruth Reichel is one of America's best-known food writers. She was the restaurant critic for the New York Times and went on in 1999 to become the editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, where she stayed until the magazine folded in 2009, just 2 years shy of what would have been its 70th birthday. A little later, we'll hear an excerpt of our 2009 interview, but we're going to start with the conversation we had in 1998 after the publication of Reichel's memoir, Tender at the Bone, Growing Up at the Table. You might think that Ruth Reichel's love of food dates back to her mother's wonderful home cooking, but you'd be wrong. Her mother was a terrible cook, so bad, Reichel describes her as taste blind. Here's how Reichel described her mother's approach to preparing food.
Well, she literally couldn't taste whether things were spoiled or not spoiled, good or... I mean, her taste was extremely limited. The first story in the book is about her waking my father up early in the morning and putting something into his mouth and having him taste it. And he said it was the single most disgusting thing he had ever encountered. And he really couldn't swallow it, and he spit it out, at which point my mother said... Mm-hmm. Just as I thought. Spoiled. I mean, she really didn't know whether it was spoiled. She really needed him to taste it to figure out whether it was good or not. Of course, the fact that it had mold on the top might have given her a clue, but it didn't.
Do you have any memories of a particularly bad dish that she served you?
Well, I mean, I think that my whole interest in food came really early because my mother, I mean, at the age of 3, she would put things on the table that... like butter that she had left uncovered in the refrigerator for a week, which was nauseating. And I would say, Mom, I can't eat this. And she would taste it and say, tastes fine to me. And, you know, when you're a child, you see that and you think, you know, there's something wrong in the world. But I think the worst thing, and this isn't in the book but because it's so simple, but she would take the dregs of ice cream cartons and pour them into an ice tray and put them into the freezer and then serve them so they would be freezer burned, mushy, and just really revolting. And then she would bring it out for a party and serve it.
Now, this is the kind of thing that might have ruined somebody when it comes to food. How did it get you to become a restaurant critic? I mean, how did it get you to become a food professional?
Well, you know, I mean, I really felt that I was sort of shaped by my mother's handicap. You know, I mean, it's the way the children of deaf people are probably more aware of sound. I became very aware of taste because I was so fascinated by the fact that my mother couldn't taste these things. And then in self-defense, I started cooking. And my mother really would make these dreadful concoctions. I mean, she really prided herself on something called everything stew, where she would take everything in the refrigerator, all the leftovers, and put them all together. And one day I was watching her put in leftover turkey and broccoli and a little, you know, can of mushroom soup. And she's throwing things in, and half an apple pie goes in. And she says, you know, I sort of look at her and say, Mom. And she says, oh, it'll be fine. And then she starts throwing everything in. And... you know, in defense, I started cooking because I didn't want to eat that.
Now, I know your first experiences in the food world as a professional was working in restaurants. One of the restaurants you worked in was L'Escargot. Would you describe the restaurant?
Well, this was in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I was going to school at the University of Michigan, and it was a very, very fancy French restaurant for the mid-60s, and certainly for Ann Arbor, Michigan, and certainly for a college town. And it was somebody's dream. I mean, I had the great privilege, really, of participating in this mad, passionate dream of the owner who did everything beautifully, which you can't do in a restaurant. I mean, he bought Baccarat crystal, which is insane. I mean, it all breaks in the first month, and Limoges china and wonderful chandeliers. And he brought a chef from the Four Seasons in New York. and he got the best grill man as a sous chef, and wonderful, wonderful waiters and waitresses, real professionals. I mean, the kind of people that you don't see very much anymore, who were very proud of their profession and very good at it. And I've always thought that a really good restaurant, when it runs well, is like being on a movie set. You become a family. It becomes a whole life of its own. And this restaurant was like that. We became very tight. And as we watched this restaurant go down.
Go down?
Well, I mean, it was a dream. Ann Arbor was not a place that could support that kind of a restaurant in those days. I mean, it was very high-end French food at very high-end prices. And people would come once for the curiosity but never come again. And as business really faded, we all pulled together. We really rooted for it. I mean, what happened was the first chef was a real thief. And I learned a lot about how, you know, most restaurants go under because of employee theft, or many of them do. And this guy was a real pro. I mean, he would take whole sides of meat, wrap them in aluminum foil, bury them in the garbage, and then go out after the garbage had been taken out. He would come back in the middle of the night and take these pieces of meat and sell them. Right. And we all really started rooting for the owner. I mean, nobody wanted to see this going on. And it was no good. I mean, ultimately, it closed.
There was a waiter at this restaurant who kind of initiated you in the ways of restaurants, and he told you that the restaurant was a war zone. What did he mean by that?
Well, it's a common thing that waiters say. I mean, what he said was that the kitchen was at war with the customers, and we were the go-betweens, and that our job was to make sure that the customers never knew that the kitchen was at war with them. And this entailed a lot of subterfuge. For instance, if a customer wanted to send a steak back because it was cooked too much, he said, now you can go back and you can tell the chef that the customer says it's overcooked. And he's going to scream and yell because he's at war with the customer. On the other hand, if you go back and you're very humble and you say, I made a terrible mistake. He said that he wanted it rare, but I wrote down well done. He'll scream at you, but he'll give you a new steak because he's not at war with you.
Yeah, but he might be at war with you if that happens too much.
Well, it doesn't happen that often, but it was just a matter of us sort of always taking the blame so that we would get big tips. He also, you know, really felt that it was our responsibility to come up with a good story for the customers. He said, you know, they should go home with more than a good meal. You have to provide an experience for them that is, you know, that they can talk about. So he encouraged me to pretend that I was a foreign student who was here and had not had enough money, and that I needed to work to support myself. And I developed a great story. I mean, my customers would be crying and giving me big tips at the end of it. But he said that this was a good thing because I was really giving them value for their money.
Now, at the New York Times, you're kind of famous for using disguises when you're reviewing a restaurant so that you can't be spotted. So you can eat anonymously. What do you use, wigs?
Not only wigs. I keep buying new wigs. I've now got 11. And I do use those. I also have a lot of glasses. I have fake fingernails. I have whole outfits in different sizes. I mean, I'll sometimes put on like three pairs of pants, one over the other, or, you know, three skirts so I look much larger than I am. I'm not normally a makeup person, but I've learned about makeup, and you can really do amazing things with, you can change the shape of your lips and, you know, change the color of your eyebrows, and I do all that stuff.
Do you pay cash or use for fake credit cards?
I use fake credit cards.
Does the Times help you get them?
No, I have figured out my own strategies for getting them. They don't want to know about how I do this. I also often ask the people I'm with to pay, and then I just write them a check.
Now, not every restaurant critic goes to such extremes to make sure they're not noticed. Why is it so important to you that you're not identified by the staff at the restaurant you're reviewing?
Well, I have a really strong belief that I am there to be your eyes and ears when you're at the restaurant. And I'm supposed to tell you what's going to happen to you, not what happens to the restaurant critic of the New York Times, who is getting the best table and the chef is, you know, cooking the food specially and the portions are getting bigger and so forth. I think it's really important for you to know what's going to happen to you. And you can't do that if you're sort of, you know, sashaying in as, you know, someone who's going to have a big economic impact on the restaurant.
Something you did that was pretty controversial, I think, I don't remember when this was exactly, but you took a star away from the restaurant Le Cirque, which I guess had been, what, 4 stars, and you demoted it to 3? Do I have that right?
Yes, you have it right.
I don't even know how the star rating works and who determines what makes a restaurant 4 or 3 stars or whatever, so why don't we start with an explanation of that?
Well, the star system is very much up to whoever the critic is at the time. And 4 stars is the most that you can get. And it's a very exalted, it's a very big deal for restaurants.
So when you say 4-star restaurant, this is like a New York Times 4-star restaurant.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And it has a lot of weight to the restaurants. When they get a 4-star rating, it's a very big deal for them. And it brings them lots and lots and lots of business. To demote a restaurant from 3 stars to 2 stars is not such a big deal, but to demote it from 4 stars to 3 stars is huge. This was right after I had arrived in New York 5 years ago. I had not had a star rating system at the LA Times where I'd been for 10 years. I wasn't that impressed with the star system at the time. I mean, I've since come to see how, if nothing else, how economically powerful it is for the restaurants. But I started going to Le Cirque, and they didn't know me, and I was not treated well. And everybody had always, you know, jumped up and down about what a great restaurant it was. And, you know, I had some really terrible experiences there. You know, I went once with another woman, and we were made to wait 45 minutes at the bar for, you know, a supposedly non-smoking table, and we were still stuck in the smoking section. And when I asked for a wine list, a maitre d' came over and snatched it out of my hands after a minute and said, "I need that list," and he took it off to some man nearby, and I couldn't get it back. And after I'd been there a few times, I thought, well, I wonder what will happen if, not if I make a reservation in my own name, but just if I go in undisguised. By then I knew he knew who I was. Sure enough, I go, and I have made the only reservation I could get was like 9:45, but I said, I think I'll go at 9 o'clock and just see what happens. And we get to the door, and there's a huge crowd waiting for tables. And the owner comes, he parts this crowd, it's like the Red Sea parting, and he comes through to me, and he pulls me forward and says, "The King of Spain is waiting in the bar, but your table is ready." And leads me to a table. And I thought, you know, this is too wonderful. I've just got to write about, you know, what happened to me as just me, an ordinary person, and then what happened to me as the restaurant critic of the New York Times, and write about the two experiences.
Now, I could see a restaurant easily explaining this by saying, well, of course we treat our regulars with special care. That's why people become regulars, because they know they're treated as like part of the family. We know what they like to eat. We know what their preferences are. We know whether they smoke or not. And it's lovely, like at a neighborhood restaurant, when you come in all the time, they say hello, they bring you the salad when you sit down, they know what you want. Everybody likes to be treated like a regular.
Absolutely, and regulars deserve to be treated. I mean, they've paid their dues, and they deserve to be treated better. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that ordinary people shouldn't be treated well.
Right.
For instance, not every restaurant can have your table ready when you arrive. I mean, they can't always calculate how long people are going to stay at a table. An apology goes a long way. If they come up to you and say, "I'm so sorry, can I give you a glass of wine? Can I somehow make this up to you?" you don't feel badly. You don't feel as if you've been dissed. On the other hand, if it's just, you know, oh, go wait over there, we'll let you know when your table is ready. It's a matter of attitude. And Le Cirque at that time was really known for not being particularly nice to ordinary people. I have to say that their attitude has changed dramatically.
Oh, have you changed their star rating?
I have. I mean, they reopened. They closed for a while, and they've reopened in a new location. And I went in many times, in many disguises, and they were wonderful. They were just wonderful. And I really felt that they had sort of seen that there was no point in not trying to be good to everyone.
That was an excerpt of my first interview with Ruth Reichel, recorded in 1998. She left the New York Times in 1999 and became editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine. I spoke with her again in 2009, shortly after Gourmet folded. She had just edited a book of recipes from the magazine called Gourmet Today. Earlier that year, she'd written another memoir. Ruth, you have a memoir that you published recently. It's really about your mother's life, not your own, although you figure into it. And it's called Not Becoming My Mother and Other Things She Taught Me Along the Way. And for people who've been following your writing over the years, they know that your mother was bipolar, that your mother was what you call food blind, that she would serve the most horrible combinations of food, like chocolate over meat, with the meat gone bad, and she couldn't tell the difference between, you know, tasty food and horrible food, or food that was good and food that was moldy. But your new book is a real change in direction. Your new book is really your mother's story from papers that she wrote, you know, letters, journals. So I just want to start with this question. The title is Not Becoming My Mother. Now, your mother had bipolar, so obviously you wouldn't want to become that aspect of her. But that title resonates. I think there are so many women who, if they were writing a memoir, could have used this title, Not Becoming My Mother. Why do you think that that is an expression that so many people will relate to?
Well, I think that there are so many of us whose mothers had very sad lives. And, you know, what I discovered with my mother was that she was thwarted in every possible way. And what she wanted for me was not to become her. She wanted more for me. And I think that there are many, many women whose mothers dreamt that their daughters would have better lives and pushed them towards that. And, you know, this book came out of a speech that I gave. And when I looked up, there were people all over the room crying and saying, "That's my mother you talked about." You know, my mother was smart, educated, and bored to death.
Yeah, well, you write in your book that you're grateful not to be any of the women of your mother's generation who were unlucky enough to have been born at what seems to me to have been the worst possible time to have been a middle-class woman. When was your mother born, so we could get a sense of what her generation was?
She was born in 1908.
And what do you think that was the worst possible time to have been a middle-class woman?
Well, you have to remember what happened during my mother's lifetime. Women got the vote. Women were supposedly emancipated. But there was nobody to tell them what that meant or how to do it. I mean, it was a very fast transition from women being essentially the chattel of their husbands to being independent creatures. And so many of them were educated for the first time. It was, you know, really the first generation of women who became doctors and lawyers, or at least had the promise of becoming doctors and lawyers. But the changes were very slow in coming. And so I just can't imagine anything more frustrating than sort of having this dangling out there, this promise of you can fulfill yourself, you can go out there and do great things, and then being held back. And on top of that, you had what happened after World War II, where, you know, women went into the workforce and proved to be really competent, and then were told to go home and tie on their aprons and give the jobs back to the guys.
I think one of the things I find most interesting about your book, Not Becoming My Mother, is that you had always assumed, understandably, that your mother's sadness, and there were months when she'd hardly get out of bed, had to do with the fact that she had bipolar disorder, and her depressions were extreme and disabling. But you found a lot of sadness that had to do with life experiences and with the confined roles of women, as opposed to just, you know, as opposed to being about mental illness. So it seems to me that that must have been a real revelation to you.
It was a huge revelation, and she was, I mean, what I discovered was this young girl who was vibrant and, you know, was extraordinarily intelligent and was not unhappy. And this bipolar illness happened much later.
You found something your mother wrote in which she said, "I hope Ruthie," meaning you, "I hope Ruthie won't rush into marriage the way I did that first time." Your mother was married twice. "I felt so desperate, and I wanted someone to lean on. My parents thought that I needed to be married. But was that really true? What if I had never married? Would my life have been better?" Did you have any idea before you read this that your mother had thought that maybe she shouldn't have married?
None. I mean, my parents actually had a very good marriage. And I know she loved my father, and I was shocked when I found that. But I understood that she really thought that if she hadn't been married, she would have had to support herself, and she would have fulfilled herself in some way that she never could.
I think with a lot of daughters, it's impossible to see your mother cry without becoming overwhelmed by sadness yourself, or maybe crying yourself. Because even during periods when you're not getting along with your mother, there's this kind of connection, this like emotional connection that I think a lot of us have felt, where you just, like, if your mother's crying, like, you can't, you are too. It's like impossible not to. Did you go through that? And reading this book, did it make you like so sad to see how sad your mother sometimes was because of social things, because of her confined roles, because of her insecurities about who she was?
Writing this book was the hardest thing I've ever done. And there's always that feeling as a child that somehow you ought to be able to fix your mother. That if you did the right thing, she wouldn't be so sad. And of course, what I'm reading as I'm going through her papers is how generous she was to me, how protective she was of me, how much she didn't want me to go through what she went through.
Let me just read an example of what you're talking about. Your mother had been told as a teenager that she was too homely to be successful. And then she writes, "How could I feel good about myself when the self-image my mother gave me was that I was sloppy, inefficient, homely, ungraceful, and ungracious? I carried that person around for so many years. I want to protect Ruthie," that's you, "I want to protect Ruthie from that. It's so hard to watch Ruthie going through this because I know exactly what she's feeling. I wish I could send her to the hairdresser, have her nose fixed, or buy a dress that will make her graceful. I know that none of that will work. All I can offer her is hope. It's one thing my parents didn't do for me." Did she offer you hope?
She really did. I mean, she told me that when I found myself, I would be beautiful. And she gave me this idea of beauty as something that reflects your self-confidence and your knowledge in yourself. And she just kept promising me, I was really a horror as a teenager. I think, you know, probably most of us are. But she just kept assuring me over and over again, "I promise you, you will be beautiful." And she told me this fairy tale of this time between her marriages when she became happy, found herself, and looked in the mirror one day and realized she wasn't that homely creature her parents had told her she was.
Now, I want to read something that really kills me that your mother wrote. And this is something you referred to a little earlier. In her late 70s, she wrote, "My mother is dead. It's time I stop letting her tell me how to live. Why should I care what she thinks? I have so little time." It's like your mother was realizing in her own way that she was about not becoming her mother. You know, yeah. Like the title of your book, like your mother had gone through something similar to what you went through. Was that a revelation?
That was a complete revelation. I mean, that's what I saw, was that she finally realized that her mother had expected her to live out her mother's dreams. And it was what she tried not to do for me. And I did not know that she had had this incredible struggle with her mother.
I think this is the final thing that she wrote, and this was after your father died. She wrote, "I am not going to lower my sights. I'm going to live up to the best in myself, even if it means some painful changes. I am no longer afraid." How old was she when she wrote that?
78, I think.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
how old was she when she died?
84, I think.
So did she live out that promise to herself?
She really did. She became the most outrageously wonderful old lady. She took people in, and after the book came out, I started hearing from some of these people who she took into her house. I mean, she'd go out in the street and meet, you know, strangers in the park and bring them home for dinner and filled her house with young people, nurtured them, took care of ailing friends.
When you say traveled. Young people, do you mean young homeless people who she found?
No, or? Not okay. No. She, you know, she. We. I grew up in the village, so she was, you know, near NYU,
mm-hmm.
and she rented out part of the apartment to students and sort of became surrogate parent.
I see.
To these people, but was, you know, was very nurturing. I mean, you know, someone wrote me and said, you know, your mother made me like myself for the first time. You know, told me not to listen to anybody else and that I, you know, needed to listen to myself. And she was the most wonderful person I ever met in my life. And this is a completely different vision of my mother than I'd ever had.
Right, you didn't think of her as particularly nurturing.
No.
I remember that when you left the New York Times to take the job as editor-in-chief at Gourmet Magazine, one of the reasons why you did it was that you wanted to be home for dinner with your son. You wanted to be able to prepare meals for him as opposed to eating out at restaurants every night. So looking back on that period of his life, he's in college now and doesn't live at home. Do I have that right?
That's right.
So looking back on the period of life when you were able to make dinner for your son and maybe for your husband too, was that good?
It was the best period of my life, I think. I mean, it was... You know, cooking dinner every night for my family was, it felt so great. And, you know, I realized that I should have done it earlier, that family dinner was hugely important for all three of us.
How were you able to get home in time for dinner as editor-in-chief of Gourmet? I mean, that's a pretty demanding job.
It is, but, you know, I walked out the door, you know, not. I didn't come home to make big fancy dinners. I often didn't get home till 7 or 7:30, but I still, you know, got dinner on the table very quickly. You know, the thing about cooking, the big misapprehension that people have is that cooking is time-consuming. The shopping part is the time-consuming. I mean, the part where you're sitting around saying, what are we going to have for dinner tonight, is very time-consuming. I mean, if it's 4 o'clock and you're in your office and you haven't figured out what you're having for dinner tonight, the battle's half lost. So what I would do was on the weekends, I would take, you know, a couple hours on Sunday to figure out what we were going to eat that week, and I'd shop for it. So when I got home, I knew what I was going to cook, and everything that I needed to cook was there.
Give us an example or two of a dish that both your husband and your son would want to eat and that you'd want to eat too. That was easy to prepare and quick to prepare after coming home from work at 7 or 7:30.
Okay, actually, there's a recipe in Gourmet Today that's called spiced chicken. And it's, you basically take chicken pieces. You can use breasts if you want. I tend to use legs and thighs. And you make a mixture of, I call it the four C's. It's chili, cumin, cardamom, and cinnamon. And you mix it with a little oil and you put it on, you pat it all over the chicken and you pan sear it. And then you put half a cup of water and you throw it in the oven for 20 minutes or so. And I mean, so this takes maybe 8 minutes of active time. It's really delicious. It's nutritious. It's low fat. You make that, you make a little bit of rice, you make a salad, you've got dinner on the table in under half an hour, and it's delicious.
Give us one more example of a good, easy-to-cook family dinner when you get home late.
Well, this is actually not in Gourmet Today. This is my favorite go-to meal, and I actually have the recipe in Garlic and Sapphires. Spaghetti carbonara, you know, it's just in the time that the spaghetti is cooking, it's done. And it's basically bacon, eggs, Parmesan cheese, and spaghetti. And it's wonderful, satisfying, delicious. I had a little girl come up to me at a book signing recently and ask me to sign that page. She was 8 years old, and she said, "This is my favorite dish on the planet."
So how do you prepare the bacon and the cheese, while the spaghetti is cooking?
You cut up the bacon. You chop it up into little pieces. You put it in a pan till it gets crisp. I put a garlic clove in there just to flavor it a little, take that out. When the spaghetti is cooked, you, depending on how much pasta there is, you break an egg or two into it. The egg cooks when it hits the hot pasta. You throw the bacon on top of it. You grate some Parmesan cheese on. Bingo.
Sounds really good.
It's really good. It's really good. It's basically, bacon and eggs, Italian style.
Ruth Reichel, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's always great to talk to you.
Ruth Reichel recorded in 2009. The book we were talking about is called Not Becoming My Mother and Other Things My Mother Taught Me Along the Way. Coming up, some insights about onions and frying from Russ Parsons. He's food editor and a columnist at the LA Times. He says it was Reichel who hired him there, and he describes her as a truly inspirational boss. This is Fresh Air. Eating out has taught many Americans to be knowledgeable about ordering subtle and complex dishes from around the world, but it has left many of us less knowledgeable about how to cook our own food. That's one reason Russ Parsons has written about the science of cooking. He says the more you know about why meat's brown, why sauces emulsify, and how frying is different from roasting, the more likely you are to be able to follow a recipe or improvise in the kitchen. I spoke with Parsons in 2001 after the publication of his book, How to Read a French Fry, and other stories of intriguing kitchen science. He's a food editor and columnist at the LA Times. He started getting interested in kitchen science when his editor assigned him to write a piece about onions. But his response at the time was,
"Onions? What do you write about onions?" And so I decided I'd do a piece about all of the kind of folklore about how onions make you cry. And so I rounded up the usual suspects and talked to chefs and things. And what I realized was that nobody that I talked to really knew why onions made you cry. And so I thought, well, I'll just kind of dabble into this food science thing and see if I can find somebody who can address that question. And it opened up this incredible array of knowledge that I didn't even know was out there. And the people were so anxious to talk. The first guy I talked to, he's a guy who'd been studying onion chemistry for like 20 years. And what he told me was really interesting. When you have an onion of whatever kind and you smell it before it's been cut, it smells different than an onion that's been cut.
Yeah, why is that?
Well, essentially an onion, and essentially most foods, are big bags of water. In the water, in the onion, there are these little vacuoles. They're little pockets of different chemicals. When you cut an onion, all those vacuoles are disrupted. The chemicals empty out, and they begin to combine with each other. You get these chemical reactions. And then those chemicals combine, the resultant chemicals combine again. And this guy, I'll never forget when he said this, because it was kind of like the key that unlocked this whole thing. He said it was a cascade of chemical reactions that occurred in the blink of an eye. And I was just fascinated by that. And so then I started pursuing the whole onion thing further, and
let me stop you. Those chemicals are what makes us tear?
Eventually. The raw chemicals don't, but after the fifth or sixth generation of combining and recombining, the result is a kind of a sulfur gas. And actually, it's not clear at this point whether the sulfuric gas goes up your nose or goes directly to the eye. But either way, it irritates you, and it makes your eyes tear as a result of that. And the great thing is that the chemical name for those chemicals are lacrimators, from the Latin word for tear, lacrima.
Well, let's get to the taste. How does the taste of an onion change when it's cut and when it's cooked?
Now, what happens is that you've got the sweet onions that you pay, $4 or $5 a pound for. Those onions aren't really any higher in sugar than the brown storage onions that you buy in a big bag for, 95 cents for 5 pounds. The difference between the two is that the sweet onions are actually lower in the chemicals that produce the tearing effect. Now, the interesting thing is that those chemicals are heat volatile, which means that as soon as they are heated, they evaporate. They go off into the air, which is also why you might start tearing when you're frying onions. So when you cook a brown onion, when you cook one of those regular old cheap storage onions, the chemical compounds go away. Those sulfuric compounds, the ones that make you cry, the ones that make the onions taste hot and unpleasant when they're raw, they go away. And what's left is an onion that's sweeter than the so-called sweet onions. What's also left behind is more onion flavor. If you've ever tried to do, I think there were when those sweet onions first came out, the first thing everybody wanted to do with them, of course, was make onion soup. Well, the result almost universally was an onion soup that didn't really taste like very much, because part of that really delicious oniony flavor is that little bit of the acidity that's left behind, that little bit of those chemicals. So you're much better if you're going to eat an onion raw, like on a sandwich or something like that. Well, those sweet onions are wonderful, but if you're going to cook them, you're absolutely wasting your money. Somebody described it. I was talking to a scientist, and a lot of those onions, the first of the really popular sweet onions, came from Vidalia, Georgia. And I was talking to one of the guys who was raising them, and he was a real good old boy. And he said that cooking a Vidalia onion was like mud bogging in a Rolls Royce.
Do you have a favorite onion soup recipe?
Probably the classic. That kind of French onion soup that where you cook the onions very long, you shred them fairly thick, actually. I cook them that way. And you cook them real low, real slow, so that they brown, they come to a very deep brown. And then you add some cognac and you add some beef stock, cook it for a little bit longer, and then you put it in the big soup plate and cover it with a crouton with some good cheese on it.
How long does that
That's
take
delicious.
To make?
That's delicious. Oh, an hour maybe.
Let's talk about the principles of frying. Now, we think of frying as being like a really hot form of cooking, but mm-hmm. compare oven heat to frying heat and how it affects the foods that are being cooked.
Well, that's one of those really great paradoxes. Why can you stick your hand in a 500-degree oven, but you can't stick your hand in 200-degree water or in 200-degree oil? It's because the way we measure heat is very imperfect. Temperature is what we usually refer to when we're talking about heat. But temperature is a measure of how fast these molecules are moving. Heat is motion, kind of. What temperature doesn't measure is how quickly the heat is being transmitted. Now, in an oven, for example, you're cooking in air, and an air is not very dense. There are very few molecules per square inch. It takes a while for that heat to transmit itself to whatever is being put in there. With water, it's more dense, and so the water transmits the heat much more quickly. Now, water has this interesting thing, too, though, that it's not as dense as oil, so that when water gets to a certain point, those molecules begin to break loose, and they go up in the air. They're steam. That point is 212 degrees. With oil, the magic of oil is that it's denser than water, and so the molecules stick together better. And so you can get oil up to 400 degrees where you can't get water any higher than 212. That's important in cooking because the kinds of browning reactions, the things that make food brown, they don't really start happening until you get to about between 300 and 350 degrees. So there's lesson one right there. No matter if you cook something when there's any moisture present, no matter how long you cook it, it's never going to turn brown.
Why does frying crisp the outside of whatever you're cooking?
The special thing about frying is that in most kinds of cooking, whether you're talking about roasting in an oven or boiling in water, the cooking medium doesn't change very much. The water stays essentially the same. The air stays essentially the same. I mean, there are fine differences, but essentially they're the same. With frying, both the oil that this food is being fried in and the food are changing all of the time. For example, one of the common problems people have with when they're deep frying things is that the first batch never turns out. Well, there's a good reason why it never turns out. With really fresh oil, again, most of the foods that we cook are made up primarily of water. Oil and water don't mix. So when you put a piece of food in really hot oil, all of the moisture comes to the surface, and it forms this a moisture barrier that the oil can't penetrate, so the oil can't really touch the food that's being fried. Now, as the frying progresses, as the oil is heated and more things are added to it, the oil begins to break down. One of the byproducts of this breakdown is soaps, or chemical soaps. These aren't the same kinds of things that you wash your hands with, but they're very close. And, you know, when you wash your hands, what soap does is it allows the water to penetrate the grease that's on your hand. The soaps in frying do exactly the same thing. They allow the cooking oil to penetrate that water barrier so that the cooking oil comes in direct contact with the food that's being fried so that it browns it better and it cooks it through more thoroughly.
So the more you use oil, the more efficient it's going to be.
Up to a point. And then the oil begins to break down to a point where you get these kinds of the chemicals come off of it. You get these nasty kinds of odors, and it's no longer working as well as it could. That's kind of where the title, How to Read a French Fry, came from. When I was talking to one of the scientists who is studying oil chemistry, they started explaining all of this stuff to me. And I said, no, give me an example. I said, well, look at a French fry. You know, the next time you go to a fast food place, look at a French fry, and you can see at what stage the oil was. I mean, there's usually four stages of oil. There's, you know, pure oil. Then there's oil beginning to break down. Then there's oil that's at the perfect frying stage. And then there's what they call runaway oil, when it's broken down to the point where it no longer functions. A French fry fried in really pure oil, really fresh oil, it won't be as brown. It probably won't be cooked all the way through. There will probably be a little bit of a raw part at the center of the French fry. When it begins to break down, that kind of first stage when it's really good for frying, the French fry will be browner, and you'll start to see it'll be cooked all the way through. When it's really perfect, when the oil is perfect for frying, the French fry will be really well browned. The corners will be really crisp. It'll be cooked all the way through, so that you have that kind of that perfect French fry combination of really crisp exterior and almost a steamy inside. And you'll have all of these delicious flavors from the oil, because good oil is essentially delicious, which is why we fry so many foods in it. Then when it gets into the runaway stage, what will happen is you'll see that it'll be brown very quickly. There will be really dark spots on it, kind of black, where it started to burn a little bit. And the French fry will have started to collapse in on itself. It won't be attractive anymore. And you'll also get the flavor. There is an old oil flavor that's not very attractive.
Everything you're saying sounds very familiar. I don't mean the information. I mean the descriptions of the French fries.
Well, see, that's one of the really fascinating things about this, is that this is all stuff that when you cook that you recognize it down the road. What this does is kind of explain to you why it's happening, in a way kind of summing up 20 years of making cooking mistakes and explaining, oh, here's what went wrong, so that it's a little bit like it's kind of a cooking course.
Well, Russ Parsons, thank you so much for talking with us.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Russ Parsons is the food editor and a columnist at the LA Times. Our interview was recorded in 2001 after the publication of his book, How to Read a French Fry and Other Intriguing Kitchens and Other Stories of Intriguing Kitchen Science. Our All You Can Eat Week continues tomorrow. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. John Sheehan directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.